The date is Thursday, February 19th, 2015. The time is 11:03 a.m. It's the hearing of the District of Columbia Rental Housing Commission. Location is the hearing room in Suite 1140 North, 441 4th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. We're here pursuant to D.C. Law 6-10, the Rental Housing Act of 1985 is amended. I'm Chairman Peter Segedy Mazak, and I'll serve today to chair the hearing. With me today are Commissioner Ronald Young, former Chairman Ronald Young, and Commissioner Claudia McCoyne. We have one argument today, notice for hearing at 11 a.m. in regards to the housing accommodations located at 4941 North Capitol Street Northeast, Unit Number 21. The tenant petition number is RHTP0929715. The case is styled Gelman Management Company, Housing Provider Appellant versus Deborah Campbell, Tenant Appellee. The commission notes that there are parties seated before it and would ask that you identify yourselves for the record, beginning with the Housing Provider Appellant.
I'm Roger Lux, appearing for the Housing Provider Gelman Management Company.
Thank you, Mr. Lux, and for the Tenant Appellee.
Morning, Commissioners. My name is Caitlin Russi, representing Deborah Campbell, and to my right is Supervising Attorney Edward Allen.
Good morning.
Thank you. Mr. Allen? I would briefly like to explain our procedures. Our rules are similar to those of the D.C. Court of Appeals. Each party will have 20 minutes to present your case, beginning with the housing provider appellant. The housing provider appellant may reserve up to 5 minutes of its 20 minutes for rebuttal following the presentation of the case of the tenant appellee. The tenant appellee must present all of your arguments within the 20-minute time frame and will have no rebuttal time. In our discretion, the commission may allow additional time for argument to a party when we engage in a number of questions that may occupy a substantial portion of your time. Our hearing is recorded on audio CD. Our decision will be issued in writing and sent to the parties as soon as we are able. We've been pretty good recently in getting decisions out within a couple of months, and hopefully we can do that in this case. In this proceeding, we do not request nor will we accept post-hearing submissions from either party. Please turn off any cell phones or other electronic equipment. We're not aware of any preliminary matters. Does either party wish to raise any preliminary matter at this time? Hearing none, Mr. Lux, please proceed.
First, I'd like to apologize to the commission for not being here last week. I was ill and out of it. Didn't even think of looking at my calendar, and apologized to Mr. Allen and sent a contribution to his law school. He was very demanding about that, but we worked it out.
I hope you're feeling better, sir.
I am. Excuse me, because I am still coughing some, so I may cough during this.
Certainly. Did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I don't think so.
Okay. We'll do. All right.
Obviously, the issues have largely been briefed, so I'm not going to go through a full argument. I do have some additional points, citations to bring to the commission's attention. Our position from day one was that there was a settlement reached under a court-ordered mediation process, that it was by virtue of its being part of that process, it's being filed and docketed. We argued twofold. One, that it effectively was tantamount to a judgment and was raised judicata. And two, even if it wasn't, Ms. Campbell's remedies for anything covered by that, and it did cover the various service facility housing code issues that she claimed in her petition dated back to 2003. Argument was that she was required to seek enforcement in the court and exercise whatever remedy she had even going forward after the date of the agreement in the court, and that by virtue of the language and the contractual terms, she had waived her right to file a tenant petition with respect to those. I want to bring to the commission's attention, I had an extra copy for council and for the commission if you'd like it, a decision from 1989 in Burns versus Dean, tenant petition 20,059, It was issued May 12, 1989. We read that as saying that if a party has entered a settlement agreement in the court, that party is required to go to court to deal with issues that arise out of the settlement. Now, it is different where, because there are cases that say this, if somebody says an agreement, we or I expressly reserve the right to file a tenant petition or go to the Rental Housing Commission for further relief, that can be done. That's clear cut. But where that's not done, our view has been and confirmed by this, we think that the remedy to begin with here was over in the court, and that Ms. Campbell had waived any right to file a petition. And she did get it, you know, she did get payment consideration and monetary consideration in exchange for her agreement. So that is the first point we wanted to make. The second point, of course, is the statute of limitations argument. That's been briefed in the motions, and you've addressed it. We're not going to go over that again. We stand by our position. But I would raise in the second notice of appeal, and we'll go back to the fact that her violation she complained of, according to her, or the findings in her own testimony, commenced in 2003. The law changed in 2006. Our view would be that whatever claim she had relating to those specific violations ended in 2006. Now, the reason I would say that, and let me, there's a case. Well, before I get into that, had she filed before 2006 for these same claims, she would have been, if she proved them, entitled to a rollback until such time as the particular problems were corrected. Under the law pre-2006, however, she would not have been entitled to a refund, because in order to get a refund, the law required that the rent charge exceed the lawful rent ceiling. Under the law, as part of a tenant petition, an administrative judge hearing examiner could lower the rent ceiling and find the rent exceeded the ceiling had she filed under that law. I would refer the court to the case which explains this in depth, Afshar versus DC Rental Housing Commission, 504 A. 2nd, 1105, DC Court of Appeals, 1986, where an award was made for certain service reductions violations, but it was found that the rent charged, even with the award and the calculations, was still underneath the lawful ceiling, and therefore the tenant was not, or tenants were not entitled to refunds. They were entitled to rollbacks until the time they were corrected. Ms. Campbell filed under the 2006 law, where there are, of course, no rent ceilings. But this specific provision of the law that deals with the remedies, well, the specific provision of the law which says, includes the provision rent cannot be increased when there are substantial code violations, has not changed. And nowhere in the law, or in the penalties provision of the old law, or the new law, is there a provision for a refund of rent collected if the rent is raised when there's substantial code violations. In fact, in that same section, it explicitly says if the judge hearing examiner finds that there are prolonged violations, they may roll the rent back to such level as to be determined until such time as the violations are corrected. Here, the judge just invalidated the two increases for all time and said, okay, we got a new maximum rent, and therefore anything above that is to be refunded. That is certainly not the way that provision of the law was interpreted prior to 2006, and given that that provision did not change in 2006, don't know why the interpretation would be different under the new law. We would add, however, though, just because of the change in the remedies and the elimination of rent ceilings, given that Ms. Campbell's, the conditions she complained of preceded the adoption of the 2006 law, that those any claims based on those ended with the adoption of the new law.
Do you have any questions?
I think that's, let me check one thing, please. There are, I think, a couple other issues, one having to do with interest and some other matters addressed in our notice of appeal. We incorporate, those are addressed in the prior filings, and we incorporate did those filings, so not going to go over those here.
All right. Mr. Young?
Do I have any questions?
Not at this time.
Let me ask you on your second argument on the change in law. There's a general savings clause in the D.C. code that talks about the repeal of a law by this title shall not affect, and then it says, any ratification, right, remedy, privilege, obligation, or liability acquired, accrued, or incurred under the statute before its repeal. Any violation of the law or any penalty, forfeiture, or punishment incurred because of the violation before its repeal. So I'm just wondering, how does the claim survive the saving statute in the D.C. code? Because I understand what you're saying to be that it somehow extinguished a right, and once it extinguished it, that right was forever gone. But if it in fact repealed by implication even, then didn't the savings clause save the right past the time that the new law was implemented, if you get my drift?
I do understand it, and the answer is no, because the general savings clause has been construed by the Supreme Court and the local court to apply to criminal statutes only.
Okay.
And what's, if I can note, just as part of this, when the law was changed in 2006, every rent control law has had a section entitled supersedure, its own savings clause.
Okay.
The 2006 law did not update that clause as every prior law had. The only savings language that was changed or added was when in the section that eliminated rent ceilings for landlord-filed petitions and voluntary agreements. Given the history of changing the savings provision supervision over the years, and given this commission's and the Attorney General's arguments for 20 years that causes of action under rent control were saved by virtue of that provision, no reference ever being made to the general savings statute you refer to. Our view is that the lack of an update in 2006 for tenant petitions or tenant pending at the time of passage or for tenant claims arising before passage it had to be intentional, because they certainly addressed the specifics of housing provider petitions, voluntary agreements, and historically for 20, 30 years, every time a new law was passed, they would revise that savings clause. They did not revise it to say any petitions pending that were filed under the 85 Act pending at the time of enactment of these changes. And certainly it was a substantial change. We're not talking about substantial reenactment here. They did not include language that said any petition pending may continue on. Now, of course, her claim was not pending and was filed several years later. None of the savings clauses ever saved claims for which there was no petition pending at the time of the enactment of the successor law.
Okay.
So, but in response, more specifically again, it has been determined and stated in several cases that the general savings provision is specifically addressed to criminal statutes because there was a common law rule applicable to criminal statutes that any change in the statute effectively abated a prosecution, criminal prosecution. And okay. That Congress enacted the law, and then the City Council included it later.
Second question, for those, you raised a couple of issues for the first time that didn't, in our remand, we were pretty specific with respect to what the remand was for. It was for kind of interest calculations, and the issues that are raised seem to be more substantive in nature and really arose or could have arisen under the first proceeding from which there was an appeal taken. And what is the, what's your position on whether or not you waived any claims that you could have raised in the first appeal, waited on remand, raised it when the proceeding didn't really raise those issues? They were really raised by the first proceeding.
Well, first let me say, practically, I only became aware of this entire savings issue in dealing with another case, which in fact is pending in the Court of Appeals and has been briefed. But the issue of savings is subject matter jurisdiction. That can be raised for the first time in the Court of Appeals. It can be raised for the first time in a reply brief in the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals has so held that even if subject matter jurisdiction isn't challenged at the trial level, it can be raised. And in fact, they've also said that a court has a duty sua sponte to raise the issue of subject matter jurisdiction itself. So it's not waived. Had I been familiar with it, I think the reason we've never dealt with it, I think because all the past laws have been effectively substantial reenactments, and all the savings clauses were updated. So to the best of my knowledge, our firm has never dealt with the issue. I had the good or bad fortune of coming across it in working on another case, and that's why it wasn't raised earlier.
And one other question, Mr. Lux, and that's on those issues that appear to have already been addressed by us. There's a contention that we've, having already addressed it, it's law of the case, and so raising it again on some of these issues, really, we've already issued a decision, and so the law of the case should apply. Do you have any response to that?
Several responses. First, the law of the case is not a firm. It's a practice. It is not a firm doctrine, and even the D.C. Court of Appeals for Superior Court has carved out exceptions. I think I say that a footnote in Goodman versus Graybill rental housing case where the court held that the commission was not bound by law of the case doctrine. And secondly, the doctrine exists when you have to apply to courts of, I think the word they use is coordinate jurisdiction. That's not the case here. You can always re-raise an issue before the same judge at a trial court, and law of the case doesn't apply. The the problem you run into is if a case is transferred to another judge who handles part of the case, and you raise that issue before that judge. This is the Rental Housing Commission. There's just one of you. So, plus in an administrative forum, the courts look for all these issues to get worked out in the forum. So, law of the case is just not a firm binding doctrine. And plus, it's, the commission's a commission. It's like if you were a judge, same judge.
All right.
I do have a question. In your first appeal, and you just stated that you carry that over into your second appeal, you make the statement that there is no jurisdiction of the ALJ to award interest. And I was trying to understand how you came to make that claim with under 14 DCMR 3826. It does provide both for the rent administrator and the commission, and of course we know that that now includes OAH, to award interest. So could you further explain that for me?
The general rule of thumb, legal thumb, excuse me, is that for any of the courts or an administrative body to award interest, there must be statutory authority to do so. It is, at least when I wrote that, and I don't know that it's changed, I have not seen statutory authority for the rent administrator or the commission to award interest. Now, to enforce these awards, of course, a tenant would go to court to enforce it, and the court has the authority to award interest, and it has the authority to award interest retroactively. But that was the basis. I don't believe there's statutory authorization anywhere for the award of interest.
Thank you.
Ms. Young?
No, I have no questions.
Ms. McCoyne, any more questions?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lux.
Thank you.
Please.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'd like to start off by requesting that the Commission use the substantial evidence standard in reviewing this case. As ALJ Hines demonstrated in her opinion after remand, that there were findings of fact followed by substantial conclusions of law, and those were reasonably met and rationally decided. All of these issues in the second notice of appeal have been raised improperly. As the commission pointed out, they violate the law of the case. The law of the case doctrine holds that the... Excuse me. Sorry, just going to take a quick drink of water.
It has kind of a res judicata kind of, we've already decided it, and
yes,
what are we,
exactly.
What are we doing?
Okay. The that unless a this an issue has been, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Take your time. What you're saying, I think, is that, and you did raise it, so let me ask you, Let me ask you what Mr. Lux would say to you, which is, first of all, law of the case doctrine is really almost an administrative convenience. An administrative setting is really not appropriate for law of the case. It has probably jurisprudential value, but it has no binding value, and as a result, you can raise issues that really, as long as they arise from a core proceeding and our core issues, just because there may have been a decision does not mean, A, that the body can't change its mind on that, or B, that it can't be raised again to remind the body that this is an issue. Okay, so it's really
kind of administrative convenience, but it has no binding effect. How would you answer that?
I would have answered that the law of the case principle does have those exceptions built in, that in cases where there is a lack of finality or a finding is clearly erroneous in light of new facts or a change in substantive law, that then those issues should be revisited. However, cases have held that the that law of the case should be abided by in the issue, in the interest of judicial economy and in the interest of honoring those decisions that have been made before. The law of the case precludes questions that were resolved by an earlier appeal in the same case, and that is what the first three issues that Mr. Lux has raised apply under. The statute of limitations argument, which this commission decided on, that ALJ Hines and this commission did have subject matter jurisdiction. His statute of repose argument has been denied by this commission as well as the Court of Appeals. As the commission pointed out in its last order, the Hinman case has found that the statute of limitations, the three-year bar in the Rental Housing Act, does not constitute a statute of repose.
Let me ask you this: statute of repose notwithstanding, we understand that. I think a more challenging issue, at least to me, is the savings clause issue on the claim that. We don't have subject matter jurisdiction because no relief was available after August 5th, 2006 for violations originating or occurring before that date. And I cited a savings clause, a general savings clause. Mr. Luck's response was, savings clause notwithstanding, there was intentionally no savings clause put in that amendment, whereas it had been put in as super deus savings clauses and other provisions of the Act. Which would indicate, or possibly indicate at least, that counsel was intending not to put a savings clause on that provision, so that it really did have the effect of an absolute repeal. And so, really, anything raised after 2006 cannot use that as a right or a remedy. Or that controls for purposes of prior acts. So how do you respond to that?
I would respond that given Ms. Campbell's problems in her house that continue to cause her injury, that those gave rise to new claims. Those new injuries gave rise to new claims. And as ALJ Hines pointed out in her first order, that any... the settlement agreement, while that settlement agreement did bar any claims before the settlement agreement was reached, anyone after, any injury that she sustained after, she was able to bring that tenant petition to in order to cure those issues that she had, especially given the housing provider's inability to remedy those issues that were reached by settlement agreement. It was within her right to bring the tenant petition to try and enforce that.
And what's the response then to the contention that these issues are those of subject matter jurisdiction and can be raised at any time? In a proceeding, anytime.
Certainly, I would say that the three-year bar in the Rental Housing Act doesn't constitute a jurisdictional bar. It's a statute of limitations that is an affirmative defense, and by failing to raise it, as the commission pointed out in its last order, statute of limitations defense was waived.
Okay, that's not the okay. That's exactly what we said, and Mr. Lux should have a counter to that, which I'm aware of. How about the change in law in 2006 that arguably repealed any rights that occurred before it? What do you and there's no savings clause, so
Again, I would say that given Ms. Campbell's new injuries she was sustaining, that just because those conditions existed prior to the change in the law does not mean that she waived any rights to file that tenant petition to try and have the conditions in her housing.
So the same core of operative fact generated later claims, and that core occurred before the change in law and succeeded it because it could be traced back to the same operative fact base that occurred before 2006.
Yes. But again, I would say that given her new injuries she was continually sustaining, those gave rise to those new claims that she could bring forward.
What about our authority to issue we have no statutory authority, do we, to put interest on or to support an ALJ's award of interest? Is there statutory authority that allows us to do that and allows an ALJ to do that?
Well, there's no statutory authority per se. The Supreme Court has found in Rogers v. U.S. That failure to mention interest in a statute does not mean that it should not be awarded. By the DCMR section 3826, the commission is empowered to award interest, saying that it may impose interest. There are cases, Jerome Management v. DCR, DC Rental Housing Commission, that stated that it was within the commission's authority to award that interest, and it is in favor of public policy to do so.
Okay.
Is Rogers in your brief?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any questions, Mr. Young?
No.
Ms. McCoy?
No.
So you have no disagreement that from 9/16/09 back to the 2008 settlement agreement is the period we're talking about, period.
Yeah.
We're not going back 3 years, we're going back that particular period.
Yeah, the amount that ALJ Hines awarded was the rollback from the 2009 and 2010 rents and the conditions, the reduction in rent for the conditions that were in substantial in compliance with the
after 2008.
Yes, exactly. And after the period that the housing provider had to remedy the issues as stipulated in the settlement agreement.
Just for clarity, I believe you said that the conditions or issues that were being raised by Ms. Campbell were ongoing for that 2008 after the settlement agreement of 2008.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Therefore, 2009, 2010, was that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Were there issues raised by Mr. Lux for the first time in this appeal that could have been raised after that were raised here that could have been raised earlier in an initial appeal?
Yes, there were.
What would your claims be on that?
Mr. Lux, in his notice of appeal, said that the reduction in services finding was arbitrary and capricious, and that as the commission pointed out, that the commission does not have the authority to award interest. The appellate court will not give considerations to issues that have not been raised below, absent extraordinary circumstances, and those extraordinary circumstances are just not present in this case. Mr. Lex was responsible of raising the merits of those decisions at the first appeal, and failing to do so, he's waived his right to raise them now.
What's your source of that?
I have the Supreme Court. It's a Blair v. Osterling machine.
Okay. That stands for what proposition?
That the appellate court will not give consideration to issues not raised below absent extraordinary circumstances. And again, those extraordinary circumstances are just not present today. The commission itself has held in Goodman that the that if those issues are not raised on that first appeal or not raised below, then they will not be considered.
Okay. Ms. McCoy, any more questions?
No.
Mr. Young?
No, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you both for your arguments. They were both very clear and they were compelling. I just on the record, is this your last appeal or is this the last time we will be seeing
you? Warned you. Yes, it is. It would have been last week, but this will be my last time. I'm going to withdraw from cases in May, and I may teach a course or two, but no more clinic work.
Will someone else be taking up the clinical responsibility?
Yes. We're in the process of hiring someone,
Okay.
and the decision has not been made.
Well, I just want to, on behalf of the commission, and I'm certain Mr. Young could speak to this, I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done. Not ironically, Mr. Lux's nephew was coached by you, and he appeared before us and did an extraordinary job. It's a real testament to you and to your program to pick up cases that would otherwise go unrepresented by people who really couldn't represent themselves. And I am would like to say we're in debt to you for your superb work and your mentoring of young people like the young lady sitting here who will be an excellent attorney, but who's cutting their teeth on stuff that's not easy. And so I thank you from us, and Mr. Young, do you have any comments?
No, I just would like to add that over the years, Mr. Allen's program has presented us with some very interesting cases and some very difficult cases because they don't shy away from those.
Right.
And I think they have taken cases that the regular bar
would not take.
Want to take.
Yeah.
And I think that's admirable, and I can say that, you know, we've had several students from his university come and serve as clerks before us and have always been outstanding.
Outstanding.
And thank you. We need all the help we can. We need all the help we can get.
We hope that we've afforded you a forum that you found productive for your students as kind of an appellate forum that's at least we try very hard to be to follow the D.C. Court of Appeals and their procedures and how we approach cases, and really Mr. Young has been here the longest, and that was his when we all both came on. That's been what we've tracked, and so we hope that we've afforded you the same forum that you've given us in developing the law of developing case law under this very, very difficult and very complex Rental Housing Act and regulations. So thank you very much, sir.
Well, I'd like to reciprocate the appreciation and say that in the last several years, our appearances here have been some of the best appearances that we've had in any forum. And, it's been extremely enjoyable. And 1 year, I think, the year young Mr. Lux is here, we had about four appearances here. It was a great deal of fun, to be honest.
Well, you really helped develop the law. I mean, you know. And again, giving tenants a place your program gives tenants a place to come for valuable rights that they otherwise wouldn't be able to be represented. And the quality of the representation you provide is so good that it's really, you know, and you're up against formidable representatives of the housing providers. And so It's really for me, it's been a pleasure to see how well you've mentored and how well these young people have done. and we've given them a place that they can at least practice what they're going to later work on in a much more, this is very meaningful, but in a much different capacity for clients. So this has been a real, real opportunity for us. Thank you, Mr. Allen.
Well, once again, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's
12:44, and this hearing of the Rental Housing Commission is over. Thank you.